Welcome to Crosstalk, Conversations that Drive Innovation. In this podcast, we featured well-known payments expert Hugo Cuevas Moore. This series is based on his 2023 book, Sending Money, Forex, Remittances, Migration, and the FinTech Revolution. Crosstalk is published by Crosstalk, a conference and consultancy service company based in Miami, Florida. Thank you for listening.
Hi, this is episode 11 of Sending Money. And in this episode and the next episode, number 12, I will discuss the beginning of remittance senders and recipients or beneficiaries' journey into financial inclusion with the advent of EFTs or electronic fund transfers that we discussed in the previous episode. And I will begin with an anecdote. It was probably a year in 1988 or 1989. When one day, an elderly lady refused to receive the $200 that her son had sent her from Los Angeles. And in her frustration, she was causing a disturbance at the cashier window in our main office in Cali, Colombia. I went out to calm her down and convince her to follow me inside so she could explain what was wrong. She was a tiny woman in her 80s, and she started talking and complaining, but it took me a while to understand her discontent. She insisted that we wanted to cheat her. She argued that the bills we were giving her were not the same ones his son has sent her. She told me, "My son marks each bill with signs that we only both of us know. We have a code." I was finally enlightened. The bills we were giving her were not the same ones his son has sent her. Of course, that was absolutely true. And I explained that to her. And she was happy that she had discovered this supposed deception. So I tried to explain the process in a way that she could comprehend. And I said, you know, your son has changed how he's sending you money, so it gets you faster. Now he takes the bills to an office closer to where he lives, an agent, and that office sends us your phone number and the amount that we have to give you. So it's the same amount of money, but not the same bills. You know, I elaborated. Then she asked me where his son's dollars were. Well, I didn't know how to explain to her that the person in the agency will put them back, will put them in the bank, and how we'll get her money later. She thought we were advancing the money while his son's dollars arrived, which I said was not the case. Anyway, the only way she left with her new bills was by me marking them so that she will have the confidence to take them with her and return to our office if she could not cash them, because she wanted to cash them with someone she knew in her neighborhood. She left peacefully. I did try to exchange those dollars for pesos so she could use them, but I understood it was too much to ask. So in this first stage of the beginning of EFTs, managing this process and getting people to trust this new way was, in my opinion, a key aspect of what we now accept as normal in transmitting money, whether domestically or internationally. When I hear discussions about financial inclusion and financial literacy, I refer to these and a number of other anecdotes I have as cornerstones in building the trust we needed from these beneficiaries to accept this change. Because the most complex aspect involves the essential transformation of customers' habits and expectations. And the use of technology as a tool for transformation was huge and impacted companies, communities, countries, impacted the service and therefore the users who adapted to this transition, the first of many transformations to come to the remittance industry. We have adapted to technological changes and now accept them much faster, with few questions and almost no wonder anymore. The paradigm shift was striking because it occurred with people of humble origins, often from marginalized neighborhoods or remote rural areas, with a bias and a total distrust of institutions. It was the start of their financial inclusion. The many anecdotes this industry has from different countries are important to understand what the industry did to change habits and bring about the needed transformation. It is what fintechs do nowadays, break molds. The change in the money sent from MOs or money orders or by people traveling with cash caused a disconnection between sender and beneficiary. The transactions intermediaries became the ethnic agents on the sending side, which were essential to establishing the trust needed in the beginning of that financial transaction. Agents were the face on the sending side in ethnic neighborhoods in many U.S. cities, as well as London, Madrid, etc., same as Buenos Aires and other Latin American cities. The agents that originated these remittances had to explain how EFTs worked. At the time, it was difficult for the sender to get on the phone and explain the change to the family they were sending money to. And as opposed to the 10 or 15 days that couriers could take, the time was immediately reduced to 2 or 3 days, then to 24 hours or less. On the receiving side, the beneficiary had to adjust to the requirement of going to an office, provide an identification, except for the countries where home delivery was provided, like Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, Vietnam, etc. With EFTs, the formalization of MTOs in Latin America was a process that began in the late 1980s and 1990s, and licensing came after companies were already in existence for some years. Now, this shift happened in different phases and different times in Latin America, and the evolution in Asia and Africa was similar. But everywhere, there was little or no dialogue between the early participants in the industry, the banks, the regulators, and the policymakers. Some early associations of remittance providers did their best to gather the companies in operation and represent them, but the sector's informality made it very challenging. In our case, UDC, Universal de Cambios, or Titan's case, Reenvia, a remittance company in New York, became our first EFT correspondent. Jesus Perez Santalla, the company's co-founder, came to our offices in Cali and explained the system to this family Casa de Cambios, a system that was not that foreign to the company that had managed a different clientele, larger payments, as Casas de Cambio did in Latin America back then. As many other people do, Eric Cuesta, an early employee of RIA in New York, fondly remembers Don Jesus, who passed away in 2018. He told me in an interview for the book, "Don Jesus Perez was a missionary. I believe he was the father of remittances. He was one of the first to start this business. He was a Cuban, a banker in Cuba, and here in the U.S., when he arrived, he was a money changer. Don Jesus worked in the foreign exchange business, and when he saw so many Latin Americans arriving in New York, he decided to organize a service to send money transfers. Licensing was new in the state, and he saw this as a good sign. Other MTOs also appeared between 1987 and 1988. They also went looking for correspondents south of the Rio Grande. UDC in Colombia began disbursing remittances in 1987. The company realized that they needed to purchase a computer to manage increased volume of transactions. And I came into the company when they asked me to purchase that computer and develop a very simple system to keep track of orders. The system was a simple table with rows and columns that revolutionized the company because it managed the information. It was a very crude version of what Excel does today. From the incoming money transfers list that were received by Telex first, we typed the available data into the table. We were able to sort it, organize the information, so the operators who made phone calls to notify beneficiaries that the payments had arrived could input information. Now, without today's cell phones and a high percentage of people not having a landline in their homes, contacting the customer was not easy. Now, keeping track of how the individual was notified, who was notified, who received the information, when, and at what time was very important. We also printed list of payments for their cashiers to prepare envelopes with the dollars in cash to be handed to the customers when they came to pick up their money next day. Operators prepared these envelopes at night to ensure we had all the dollars needed. But even if we exchanged dollars all day, it was never enough. The preparation and alphabetical sorting of these envelopes, the calls, the provision of funds was a very intense task to handle, but it had to be done before the client arrived to the office, so it could be done efficiently. Cashiers had to manually keep track of paid transfers, the time, the date, take information from the ID presented, and we needed to input this data in the computer. As the number of clients increased, technology kept on presenting us with solutions so we could grow while keeping controls in place. With the arrival of the fax, cheap and easy to use compared to the telex, and the appearance of new MTOs in many cities in the US and later in other countries where migrants were settling, the money transfers we were handling skyrocketed in such a way that it was almost impossible for us to plan accordingly. The need for more offices to pay remittances, the need for better methods and controls, the increased use of computers, the need of better software to simplify the operation, the cash flow, both in the country and the management of credit lines and credit risk with correspondents, all of this became the main aspect of the business. And even if dollars were openly, but not freely, in the 1980s in Colombia, the foreign currency exchange was controlled. And in some countries, authorities tried, and some continue to try, prohibitive measures against the trading of foreign currency, pushing businesses to operate in gray markets. Bob Lopez shared his history of his family business for the Sending Money book, and I'm going to read it to you. My dad and my uncle had a casa de cambio in the Dominican Republic that exchanged dollars. People came with the dollars they received from tourists, but the volume began to increase, and my uncle said one day, "Oye, where are all these dollars people bring coming from?" They started asking customers and discovered that the money was being brought by individuals from New York every week, every 2 weeks. My uncle decided to start doing the same. When the fax machines appeared, they decided to open an office in New York so that people could go to this office and take the money. And that was in 1987, I think. And thus, Consorcio Oriental began in the U.S. In Brazil, the formalization of the remittance market took much longer than any other country in the region. In a later episode, I will go into more detail about the transformation of this market. Geraldo Magela, who worked 30 years with Brazil's central bank, remembers the years before 2005 when the central bank had to authorize every international money transfer. A reason why there were so many alternative methods to move money in and out of Brazil, the famous black or gray market. Let me read what Geraldo told me for the book. I worked in one of Brazil's central bank offices that authorized people to buy foreign currency. I remember the case of a man who came to ask for an authorization. He needed to buy $100 to send to his son, who was alone in Chile and had an accident. I helped that father write the formal request that was needed, and I went to my boss, and he didn't authorize it. It was for medical treatment, and he did not approve it. The father was crying at my desk. It was 1981. Can you imagine? People needed to go to the central bank for an authorization, buy the currency, and give Aircruz the money. Of course, no wonder there was a huge parallel market in Brazil for so many years, serving people like this father that Magela remembers in the interview. Rocio Mautino, a founder with her other family members of a company in Peru and Chile called Argentpair, told me in an interview how their family remittance services began. It all started when my brother, Lombardo Mautino, may he rest in peace, went to study in Argentina. And when he traveled from Buenos Aires to Lima to visit us, his friend always sent money with him to give to the families. That is why we got together at that time. It was the year 1990, because we, as a family, saw a need for Peruvians to send letters, parcel, packages, and money home, taking advantage of the trips people we knew were doing back and forth. The situation in Peru became very complicated with the Fujimori government, and many in Peru left at that time. Little by little, we integrated the rest of our brothers and sisters. Some went to open offices in other countries. In my case, I opened the office in Chile, where I still live. Building trust was the number one priority for customers to shift their habits and come to get their payments. From the beneficiaries, mostly from poor neighborhoods, being called from a downtown office to pick up money sent by a relative made them feel distrustful and vulnerable. And trust building began from the initial phone contact to inform the beneficiary that a remittance from abroad was available. Then came the process of making them feel welcome in a safe, clean, and friendly space, accommodating this customer politely as they enter the office, asking courteously for proof of identity while ensuring payment to the correct person, was not left to chance. The vulnerability of these customers could generate hostile attitudes in a matter of seconds. So we had to work with our employees to generate empathy with these clients who were unaccustomed to being in an office, signing forms, encouraging them to be patient, understanding their mistrust, and even their hostility. As we grew, we had to recruit new personnel. Some came with banking experience, which in practice proved to be good in terms of operational skills. But deep down, their presumptuous attitude, inherited while working as bank tellers, was hard to change. Bank tellers in the third world, even if they come from middle or lower class backgrounds, feel that the seat at the teller's desk is like a throne, and from there they can treat everyone as vassals. In Colombia, that was especially true in the 80s and 90s. They felt entitled. One of the interesting things we found very early on was the question beneficiaries asked when they were notified by phone or when the remittance was being paid at the office. People will ask, "Is my son okay?" It was easy for our staff to say, "I have no idea, ma'am. I only have your name, phone number, and your son's name." And that was true, and it could have been said politely, but that was perceived as being rude. I remember trying different answers to create the empathy we always sought. A cashier came up with the following response. "Listen, he must be very well because he sent you this money. One can tell he loves you very much." Logically, the response will generate a thank you and a sense of reassurance. This simple phrase became a motto in our company. And it is not a minor detail. The search for empathy was our mission, leading us to create dozens of subtle ways to handle the situations that arose in those early days. All the pioneering companies in the industry developed the search for empathy with the customers, whether on the sending or receiving side of a remittance corridor. Countless times I have discussed this issue of empathy in financial services. Ethnic remittance companies felt it was a duty to forge it, to nurture it. Agents knew how to inspire confidence in their connationals to send their money, and we on the paying side had to close the empathy cycle effectively. So finding and training good people to deal with this new clientele became a necessity. We also needed younger people who will feel at ease with the new technology tools we were using. When we began paying remittances, there was no measure of the scale of the service, nor the size of the market, and even less what it will become so soon. We had an office on the third floor of a small building in downtown Cali, accessible via a narrow staircase or an old elevator that was run by an operator. But this new clientele, growing by the day, began to irritate the employees and owners of other offices in the building, who felt that it was being degraded and devalued by the poor clientele we were serving. In response to the growth, the intense pressure from correspondents abroad, and to serve beneficiaries in other cities and towns, we started to open branches nationwide. The first offices we opened were informal. Trusted friends and relatives rented a central location apartment to distribute remittances, small offices in discreet buildings, nothing too fancy. Throughout this first period, the company preferred to rent locales on a second or third floor because they were much safer for the operation, and the people who left our offices with money felt more secure because they could go into the street unnoticed. In 1992, when Titan got the country's first Casa de Cambio Plena license, the company began searching for locales to accommodate the growing number of clients. Now, newly constructed shopping malls were a good solution, but it was challenging to convince the management of these centers to let us move in. Casas de Cambio had a poor image. Remittances were not understood. The clientele was discriminated. And even the fact that finally a regulation in Colombia was in place, it was not a convincing argument for those shopping centers. We finally managed. From an office in Cali with 8 people in 1987, the transition to Titan in 1992, as a result of the new regulations in Colombia, we reached close to 435 employees and 73 branches, handling a volume that exceeded 200,000 remittance orders paid in December of the year 2000. At that time, we were also handling outgoing remittances, about 6,000 a month, still cashing money orders and handling foreign exchange operations. At the same time, we opened offices in neighboring countries. Initially, with the support of friends and people we trusted, we began operating in Venezuela, Panama, Costa Rica, Honduras, Salvador. We were able to offer payment options to correspondents who, even if they didn't have much volume to these countries, were important for us to offset the funds they sent to Colombia for payments. We became what is now called an aggregator for the region. We also decided to operate our own office in Miami first, then Boston, since it was important for the company to secure a certain market share at its origin. Correspondents were demanding more credit, and this was becoming an ever-increasing risk. As the MTOs in the U.S. and Europe grew and competition in the payment markets increased, commissions and fees were shrinking. Having a network in the U.S. was also a way for Titan to pay remittances in those markets, something that ethnic MTOs in the U.S. would not do, apart from Western Union and MoneyGram, because most of the MTOs only concentrated in outgoing remittances from the U.S. or Europe. We understood that the remittance market was being increasingly controlled from the sending side. The originating companies were becoming more powerful, while the paying side was gradually losing profits. Being in the two sides of a corridor helped us to learn more about the clientele and to work even more in the financial inclusion, in the trust building and empathy that we needed in both sides of the chain.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Crosstalks, Conversations That Drive Innovation. The book, Sending Money, is available on Amazon. For comments, questions, and feedback, use our social media channels, LinkedIn, Facebook, and YouTube. See you soon.